This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, a podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy today and in the future. My name's David Brett, and on today's show, we take a deep dive into a major study of global investors. We find out what they were really doing during the height of the crisis.
I'd love to know. But honestly, ignorance is bliss sometimes. But specifically, like you, I'm mystified.
Their eye-wateringly high returns expectations.
Investors, if they're going to take risk, they expect that kind of return. And whether they're right or not in terms of achieving it, but that's really the kind of return they're expecting.
And they're craving for more information.
In the asset management world, people are recognising that we need to be part of the solution coming out of this crisis rather than the problem.
Hello, how are you? I hope you're all safe and well. Welcome to the show. Over the past few months, we've spoken a lot about how violently the stock market and investments have been swinging around, almost as prodigiously as a Jimmy Anderson delivery, one for the cricket lovers out there. We've talked hypothetically a lot about how investors might deal with volatile markets, be it leaving investments alone or at the very least taking a prudent view of the assets they own before disposing of them. Well, today we're going to hear from the investors themselves. Whilst markets were tanking and economies were closing down and the virus was spreading fear and panic, what did investors do? We'll also find out what types of returns they're expecting from their investments in the future and whether that has been affected by COVID-19. Spoiler alert, it is surprising. And the knowledge they crave to help with their decisions. To find out, we're going to probe the findings of Schroeder's Global Investor Study, which surveyed more than 23,000 investors across 32 worldwide locations between 30th of April and the 15th of June 2020. Now, to help me dissect the findings, I'm joined by a man we know who loves investing and saving. We've not had him on the show for about a year, but it's a pleasure to welcome back Rupert Rucker. He's head of investment solutions here at Schroeder's. Rupert, it's been a while. How have you been?
David, hello. Thanks for inviting me. Very good, thank you.
Yeah, I understand you've been on holiday, but somehow evaded the quarantine measures.
Yeah, no, we chose Greece, so lucky us, and it was a wonderful time. Yeah, very grateful to get away.
And we've also got on the line Sheila Nicholls. She's head of public policy at Schroeder's. Sheila, how have you been?
I've been well. Enjoyed a short holiday, and now really back into it.
And for Schroeder's, you're head of public policy. Can you just give us a brief explanation as to what that means?
Yeah, it's my job to engage with policymakers, mainly in the UK and Europe, basically to influence the overall policy, political and regulatory environment that we work in for the benefit of our clients and for Schroeder's and the industry as a whole.
And we'll be hearing more from Sheila in the final part of the show when we tackle the investment knowledge investors crave and who's responsible for providing it. But in part one, we'll take a look at what investors did during the crisis.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So just a quick reminder, US stocks ended their longest bull run in stock market history in February as investors began to realise the extent of the pandemic. What followed was the sharpest correction in stock market history. At the time of recording, August 25th, US stocks had recovered to their all-time highs. But what were investors actually doing during the period of crisis? Well, the Schroeder's Global Investor Study found that 78% of respondents said they made some changes to their portfolio as a result. Only 19% said they kept their investments where they were, and a small 3% were unaware of the turmoil in markets, so took no action. So first of all, Rupert, what did you make of the 3% that said they were unaware of the turmoil at all?
Yeah, no, I'd love to know. But honestly, ignorance is bliss sometimes, because actually fiddling too much with your portfolio might not have given you any benefit given what the recovery in markets. But specifically, like you, I'm mystified.
Yeah, I mean, we did a little bit of research about a month ago, just when markets were approaching back to their near highs around the end of July, and it suggested that $1,000 invested when markets were beginning to tank and just left alone would have left you slightly in profit, where if you had missed the 10 best days trying to dive in and out, you'd have actually lost quite a bit of money. So yeah, like you say, ignorance might be bliss. But of the 78 who changed their investments, 53% moved some or significant portion to lower risks investments. So what risks are there of moving investments into lower risk investments, Rupert?
Yeah, no, I think this is a worry, and it's a natural reaction to a very stressful environment. The concern is twofold. One is by moving into lower risk investments, that's by definition lower return, and actually much, much lower return going forward. A, because interest rates are now at zero or even negative for fixed income, particularly interest risk-free fixed income like government bonds. Or B, you know, actually, if investors want to get back into the markets, timing that is really tough. As you've just said, if you miss the top 10 best days, you've missed out on almost 50% of the upside. So I think that is concerning, that moving into lower risk investments, people understand what the consequences really are.
And what type of problems does that cause investment managers or financial advisors?
Well, I think for financial advisors, it really causes a problem in meeting their investor outcomes, their client outcomes. Their clients have come to them and reasonably said, you know, this is what I want from my investments. And if by moving into lower risk investments, they can't meet those objectives, then there will be some dissatisfaction. For investment managers, that causes redemptions, and it causes selling into illiquid markets, selling, you know, stocks at the wrong price. So it's not really ideal for meeting clients' objectives.
A significant proportion, 35%, actually took a contrary action. So they moved into high risk investments. Clearly, that is a risk at the time when the market's tanking. But is there any reason for them doing that instead of maybe moving into safety?
I think, you know, we've got to give clients credit. And I think what one thing we're looking at from these surveys is actually the increasing maturity of respondents. And, you know, I honestly think most people who did this took a decent opportunity. They saw valuations come down. They know they need to be investors, and they took that opportunity to invest some cash and then increase their return profile going forward. As long as, you know, they realize what those risks are, and that education piece we're going to explore in the podcast later on. But that education piece is the most important aspect of this.
We've also spoken about the record bull run that stocks were on before COVID struck. Might investors have been thinking about that when they took on some of this risk, bearing in mind how far they've come since the financial crisis?
I think exactly that's right. So we've seen this 10-year markets going up, and I think a lot of investors got increasingly left behind. And that doubt played a role. I agree. Yes.
And we've also got some data around what different people of different ages were doing. And it's clearly a fact that millennials were almost twice as likely to alter their portfolios as their parents, the baby boomers, as far as the research showed. Is there something more structural in that, or is it just a demographic thing?
I think it's largely demographic. Ultimately, if in the older cohort, you're actually relying on these investments in many ways for your income. So actually fiddling around with them is going to decrease in some respects the dividends that you're receiving. And you have less time to take risk. Whereas the much earlier cohort, the millennials, have got plenty of time. The main issue and the main recommendation we would make is to keep invested. It's that coming out of investments and trying to time back in again that causes most of the problem.
Yeah, so I suppose the big message to the youngsters, and it seems like they may have done, I don't know how many of the youngsters actually moved into more high-risk investments, is that they have got time to recover any losses and perhaps potentially making even more profit.
Exactly, but they shouldn't be going in and out of cash. That doesn't make sense at their stage in life. Certainly, you know, you can switch. That's fine, depending on your circumstance, but remain invested.
Okay, so that's the end of part one. In part two, we're going to look at the surprising returns investors expect in the future.
get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
The savers predict an annual return of 10.9% per year over the next 5 years from their stock market investments. That's up from 9.9% in the survey in 2018. That's even as COVID-19 halted the longest economic expansion on record and plunged the world into a deep recession. So what might be guiding those future expectations, Rupert?
I think fundamentally it's the experience of the past, and those annualized returns have been delivered if you've been invested in markets, and that's equities and fixed income, because of that massive bull market in equities driven by the US, and you know the 20-30 year bull market in bonds all the way down to zero interest rates. So I generally think it's been driven by what the past experience has been. I would also say that investors, if they're going to take risk, they expect that kind of return, and whether they're right or not in terms of achieving it, but that's really the kind of return they're expecting.
We touched on it in the previous section about investors moving or potentially moving some of their portfolio into cash. We know that 18%, so nearly a fifth of investors, did do that. I mean, if they're wanting returns of 10.9%, it seems if they're going to move into cash, it's going to be difficult to achieve that. So what does it mean for their intentions going forward if they're holding this much cash?
Yeah, I think that they would genuinely have to understand two expectations. Either they have to reduce their overall return expectations quite significantly, or they're being opportunistic and they will reinvest that cash. That comes with dangers in terms of timing. But there's no way if you move 20%, nearly 20% of your portfolio to cash, you can achieve those kind of return expectations.
OK, we won't run through all 32 countries' expectations, but we'll just give you some of the highlights. Remember, you can find out all the findings at schroeders.com/GIS. But the country where investors expect the highest returns is in the US, 15.4% per year. That seems extraordinarily high. Again, are we looking at what's gone on in the past for the reasons why they might be expecting that?
Yeah, I think there's a significant correlation between to the strength of economies. You know, the US economy has led the world, the markets have led the world, the dollar has been strong, everything has been in favor for US investors, and that's without doubt behind their return expectations. And you only have to look at other countries where the economic situation has been much worse or returns have been much worse to see that there are lower expectations, you know, particularly the likes of European investors or Japanese investors. So, you know, I think it's just a function of the US has had this amazing market leadership for many, many years now.
Yeah, and just looking at some of the other countries, a few of the emerging markets, Indonesia, Argentina, Brazil, India and Chile, they have among the highest hopes. They're looking at annual returns around 12%. Again, is that linked to the economy, maybe high interest rates?
Yes, so there are those countries that you've highlighted, really apart from Chile, funnily enough, have had very high interest rates. Now, adjusting for inflation, that doesn't necessarily mean they've had great returns. But still, when you have the high domestic interest rates, you have a choice that others don't. You can actually keep your money in government bonds and achieve nominally quite a good return. And that would definitely have an impact on your expectations to take risk compared to other countries where government bonds basically give you zero.
That's a good point that you bring up. Actually, these aren't inflation adjusted returns. These are total returns, which include both dividends and the capital gains. So Japan was the lowest at 6%. European countries expectations averaging around about 9%. But is there a problem for financial advisors if investors are linking expectations to past returns? Is there a deeper conversation they have to have there?
Yeah, there is. And certainly when, for example, I go and see advisors in the UK and in other countries, that is a conversation we have. Because, you know, the products that they're buying and the advice that they're receiving, that will not deliver those expectations. So, again, that education piece is so important going forward.
Which brings us neatly on to the final section of the show where we discuss the information that investors crave. So it's time to welcome back Sheila Nicol to the show. Her area of expertise is public policy, and it fits nicely in with the third part of this show, which is all about investors craving for information. And the GIS survey found an overwhelming 97% of investors want some level of personal finance knowledge. Sheila, how encouraging is that?
I think that's absolutely brilliant, because I think one of the issues in many cultures is that somehow we don't talk about money. And that often seems to translate itself into saying, well, actually, I don't need to understand finance. And that might have been okay in the days where things were done for you, in the days of defined benefit pension schemes and so on. But I sense that people are recognizing now that they really have to take more responsibility for their own future financial well-being. And so I think it's really good that people have this desire to have more understanding of personal finance. And it suggests that generally in societies, we haven't been particularly good at supporting people in understanding money.
Yes. Yeah, so do you think this is something that's been more forced upon them recently? Like you say, just with the fact that the pension situation has changed so drastically in the last decade or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are realising that they need to take more responsibility for their money. But I also think, you know, we talk a lot more about about well-being generally. And I think there's, you know, mental well-being, physical well-being. And I think people are also see financial well-being as part of that. And the more you can understand the money, the more you can understand that process, the more you know where to find support in helping you in that. I think the more you feel in control, and therefore that adds to that sense of well-being. And I sense that is what may lie behind some of the answers that have come through in the survey.
A further half of those that were surveyed at least want enough knowledge to verify or probe the advice they're given, which is great because everyone should be held accountable. One third wants significant knowledge, enough knowledge to be able to invest without necessarily seeking professional help. Well, what's your views on that if people just want to go in alone?
Well, of course. You know, it's entirely there are people who've got time and the inclination to want to look after their own money. It worries me slightly if they're thinking it's because they don't trust advisors. You know, I think there has been an element of that. I don't know where to look for advice, so therefore I'll just do it myself. But I'm also very encouraged that, you know, another half are saying that they actually want to have enough knowledge to probe the advice they're given. And I think that's really, really positive that they do recognise the value of advice and they do want to be able to have a grown-up conversation with an advisor because financial decisions can really be quite complex sometimes. And I know the survey was focusing particularly on investment. But I think also it's important for people to see that advice as part of the sort of that investment as part of a sort of broader financial planning exercise. And so the fact that they want to, as I say, have a grown up conversation with their advisors, I think is extremely positive. As I explained at the beginning, I'm also involved in the regulatory world, and regulators often worry about mis-selling. And there have been a lot of cases of mis-selling in different circumstances. Well, the best way of protecting yourself from mis-selling is to have some understanding of the advice that you're being given and to probe that. So I think that's a really, really positive development.
You mentioned trust there, and I know the financial industry as a whole hasn't done themselves too many favours. I'm talking mainly around the global financial crisis 10 years ago, but are they doing enough now to regain some of that trust with their investors?
Well, I hope so. And I mean, I certainly think in the asset management world, people are recognising that we need to be part of the solution coming out of this crisis. Rather than the problem. And I think we do recognise that there are responsibilities on ourselves to
maintain long-term relationships with the companies that we invest in, to look at wider. I think it's going to increase our focus not just on environmental issues but on social issues. So I think there are opportunities for the financial services industry actually to prove that they can actually be a force for good, rather than, as you say, that negative connotation that the financial services sector has still got post-financial crisis.
And given the pandemic we're in, it's going to be even more important going forward as well. And that sort of leads us nicely on to the responsibility, who's responsible for giving that advice and or finding that knowledge. And we're seeing 72% of people feel like they're personally responsible for their own primary source of financial info, while 68% think themselves should be responsible. So again, people are taking on that onus themselves, but financial providers were high up on that list as well, 62% and 52% respectively. So what more should financial providers be doing to help people with that financial knowledge?
Well, I think one of the things we've got to do is talk in their language. We haven't generally traditionally been very good. We've tended to use jargon. We've used language that is we're comfortable with, but we haven't taken a step back and said, well, actually, this is a rather arcane world that people have stepped into. So I think as financial services providers, we do have an onus on us to try and speak much more the language, put ourselves in the shoes of investors. Perhaps sometimes as fund providers, as asset managers, we've tended to think of the client as being the intermediary, the institution. We are increasingly, I think, now thinking about the end customer. So that has to be a good development. One of the other interesting results of the survey was about getting information about finance in schools. Now, that's clearly a long-term approach, but I do think it's very good that there has been a lot more thinking about financial education in schools, giving us the basics at school, which then at least provide a starting point that we then have some understanding of financial services. I don't think it's a question of you know, doing a complete download at school, but as I say, it's that foundation that you can get at school. One of the challenges in that, I am involved in various initiatives in this area, is actually getting the teachers confident enough to talk about money, going back to my original thoughts that that people just don't talk about money, they don't feel confident about talking about money. So finding ways of helping and supporting the teachers, and not necessarily seeing talking about money as something over there that you do, you know, an hour a week, but recognizing that in life, money pervades much of what we do, and the same thing can be the case in schools. So you can talk about money in history lessons, you can talk about money in English lessons, not just in maths or economics lessons. So I also think in thinking about sort of financial education and where people get the information, it's worth thinking about a bit more creatively. So one of the most successful financial education initiatives that I came across was actually working with midwives, because engaging people to talk about money at a point in their life when they're open to thinking about it. So actually giving materials to midwives that they can give to expectant mothers was one of the most successful ways that I've heard about in terms of engaging people with money and helping them understand money. So I don't think it's about necessarily traditional chalk and blackboard, using my very old-fashioned way of thinking about these things. It's also about finding opportunities in people's lives to help them when they need help, and to be there and have a way of making sure that they know where to go to look for the information. So that's also where I think governments and regulators can then, I know there was also a question about governments and regulators, what role do they have to play? And I think they can play a role in pointing to where information is available and where they can, where people can go to ask questions about money and investing.
Well, that was the show. Many thanks to Rupert Rucker and Sheila Nicol for joining me. You can find out much more from the Global Investor Study at schroders.com/GIS. If you have any follow-up questions or ideas for future shows, contact us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. You can read and listen to more from the Investor Download at schroders.com/theinvestordownload. And remember to rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Shows are released every Monday and Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.